So what an exciting day to hear more about Greg Funderburk. And I want to start, Greg, with you telling us a little bit. So the way I structured this, I did early, mid, and late. It's kind of like a music, you know, history class. So, but we're going to talk about the early period. So tell us a little bit about your family, your parents, siblings.
All right. Yeah, thanks for the roadmap there, Carrie. My mom and dad were married in about 1961, I believe. Larry's like thinking back. That's probably about right. He was best man, I think, in that wedding. My dad was born in Elkhart, Texas, in East Texas. He grew up in a lot of different places in Kermit, Texas, way out in West Texas. He went to high school there. His dad was a school teacher, a mailman, and did a lot of different things in his life. And my dad was born in 1925, and so he served in World War II. He was in the Navy. He was a CB. Was just at the tail end of the war, was sent overseas, was not in combat, came back and finished school, and then became a lawyer here in Houston and practiced law for a long, long time, had his own firm. Larry, my uncle, joined him in the practice of law, and eventually I did as well. My mother was born in Oklahoma. Her dad worked for a department store called C.R. Anthony, if you might have heard of that. And he moved around too. He was in Oklahoma, then in South Texas. I think he was even in New York for a little while. My mother became an occupational therapist and worked at TIER just across the way and some other places, and worked with polio victims and burn victims a lot before she got married and became a homemaker and had four kids. I was the second. My brother David is the oldest. He's a lawyer here in Houston. Then there's me a couple years later, actually about 13 months later. So me and my brother were very close and played a lot together, did a lot of sports together. And my sisters, Susan is the next one, and she is now in California. She works for Warner Brothers in their music department. She puts music into TV shows and movies and things like that. And then my youngest sister, Laura, works in Washington, D.C. She works on the Hill, Capitol Hill, in a congressional group. So, yeah.
That's really cool. And not too long ago, there was a sale, of course, of your old home you grew up on. And I just happened to be driving in the car with Greg one day. And he said, hey, you want to go see the house? And he took me back in this little part of Memorial, back in sort of a cul-de-sac, right? It was sort of end of the street. And there was this beautiful, nice little laying ranch. And I say this because I was so intrigued by that, because so many of Greg's illustrations and sermons, he talks a lot about, you know, I was walking down the hall of the house, or dad, you know, there's some story about the home. So it was kind of nice to put a visual on that. Tell us about the house and where you were.
I think I literally grew up in the greatest place in Houston. I mean, it was just, it was great. It was in the Memorial area. And my dad, I understand, super stretched to get this, to buy this property, mid-60s. And it runs right up to Carter Lake, which runs into Buffalo Bayou. And so literally we had a lake that ran into the bayou in our backyard. We had a big backyard and played lots of sports there, and even took some boat trips down the lake, into the lake, and then down the bayou.
What kind of boat? How big is this lake? Do y'all know about this lake?
The lake itself isn't that big, but then it feeds into the bayou, which goes all the way, of course, from... Yeah, I don't know where it starts, but it goes all the way downtown and beyond into the Ship Channel, I guess. We didn't go that far, but we did go from the Memorial area. We lived on Little John, if you know where that is, Friar Tuck, Antoine Memorial kind of area, all the way down to like where Otto's used to be in the International House of Pancakes. And we took the boat all the way down there, and then we'd get out. Mom would pick us up. We'd put the boat on the top of the station wagon and drive back. And then I did that some when I was older too with my friends. We'd get a raft and do it, and we'd take three rafts, and by the end of the trip there'd be zero rafts left.
Was one of your friends' names Huck?
Huck, yeah, it was kind of a Huckleberry Finn type thing. Lots of snakes. And then we made movies back there. We did Dante's Inferno. You might have It was.
Of course, it was Dante's Inferno, and not like some shoot 'em up Western thing, right?
It was overlooked in the Academy Award nominations again. And then we did a myth, some Greek myths. Anyway, we had great fun. It was a great place to grow up.
Now, something I learned in this little process is that you met Kelly rather early in your life. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I did. In sixth grade, in the second semester of sixth grade, I got moved to a class, or it was a new class in the semester, and it was Ms. Fox's math class. And I remember going into the class and looking like in the last row and going, you know, at age, whatever, 13, going, that girl is really beautiful. I really was like, it was like, you know.
This is being recorded. This is being recorded.
Yeah. It was striking to me. And she was just very attractive to me. And I sort of tried to get to know her. I was pretty shy. Turned out in seventh grade, my best friend beat me to her. And so he became boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever, go steady, whatever you do in seventh grade. And then she broke up with him. And I think just to get back at him, she started kind of going out with me. But I was tenacious. And eventually we kind of got together in high school.
So I'm walking in the fellowship hall one day and Ruth Campos, Carrie, come here. I got to tell you something. And she shares this tidbit of information. Ruth, a little birdie, has been privy to a little kiss action between Kelly and Greg in those early years. Did you know this?
This is an apocryphal story, I think.
I couldn't tell if she saw y'all kiss on the front porch or like over the fence. Like, is Ruth climbing over a fence and looking?
It sounds like she was spying.
It's a little sketchy.
But yes, we did. Kelly grew up right in their neighborhood, and our first kiss was on the porch. But
nice.
It was probably at 2 a.m. after junior prom. Not Ruth probably didn't see.
She's
that.
A night owl. Ruth's a night owl. I'm sure she probably saw it. Sure she. Now we all know about baseball, and so I just want to know where in your life. I mean, what was it? You know, Little League with Dad, or I mean, what was it, and when did that whole interest come in, or all sports maybe?
Yeah, really all sports, but especially baseball. My dad took me to Astros games when I was very little, and I think I mentioned this in a sermon one time. I have his old diaries, and just thumbing through the diary was just amazing. Like almost every week, went to Astros game, went to Oilers game, went to Rockets game with the boys. And I just realized that he really did. Although he worked really hard and worked late on you know, many work days, he really was with us a lot, especially on the weekends, and we did things together. And I remember he was in the Big Brothers program, and he had a big brother, a little brother that would go with us to some of the games. But I just remember always going to the Astro games, sitting up in the purple seats, the loge level a lot, and just fell in love with baseball, both playing it and watching it. Same for football and really same for basketball too. I was okay, but I wasn't like an elite player, but I really did enjoy sports growing up, and some of my best friends remain from those days.
So you're plugging along through middle and high school. You're dating Kelly. You're enjoying
off and on.
Yeah,
sadly.
Like you do. It comes time for making a decision for school. And you're in high school. Do you already have a hint toward law? Are you already tracking that? Or where did Baylor come into picture?
Yeah, I kind of always thought I would be a lawyer. I don't know exactly where it came from other than I looked up to my dad a lot. But we used to go, you know, on weekends to his office, and I kind of saw what he was doing. And it was and it seemed appealing to me. And maybe not even so much the law as that he was his own boss. He had his own firm, so he was his own boss. No one was telling him, you know, when he had to do this and when he had to do that, other than, I guess, the bottom line. That was appealing to me. And then when I went to college, I just kind of by that time I knew I was going to try to get into law school. So I did things that I liked. I was a history major, really kind of enjoyed reading history and connecting in that way, and then went to University of Texas for law school. Where I realized, you know, after the very first test, I think in December of my first year in law school, and the first year of law school is very challenging, I realized I was not the smartest guy in the world. And I, of course, I knew that.
Everybody just eye rolled. I just saw them. They all.
No, I mean, you know what I mean, though? It's not that you think you're really the smartest guy in the world, but all of a sudden you realize you're in the middle of the pack. I mean, you're like, you know, and it was just very.
Well, you're at UT, right? I mean, that's.
Well, it was very eye opening to me to say, to see people that were just so much more advanced in terms of putting things together, and it was challenging, but it was really a blow. Like, it was really sort of like, okay, I kind of got to really kick it into gear a little bit, and I think I've just always remembered that. I hope that kind of keeps you humble when, even though you feel like, you know, you're in the place where you want to be, there's people that you need to listen to because they're smarter and have more experience than you.
Baylor gets a new coach. They got a good team. Down the future, we find some random weird situation where Baylor and UT play each other. Who do you pull for?
Oh, yeah, definitely Baylor. Okay. I grew up going to Baylor games. I grew up going to my buddies. I'd go to UT-Baylor game, and UT would always crush Baylor in the 70s until 74. And so I hated UT in terms of football. But I like them now just because I went to school there.
So getting off sports, school, and everything else, let's get to church, the real business here. So you didn't always attend South Main. So when I came, you were, Greg on staff. Oh, but he was also previously a member. I'm like, so I'm thinking Greg grew up, he's a good old South Mainer, but then that wasn't the case.
Yeah, no, I grew up at Tallawood, and I wasn't super active. I saw Larry Bertrand at the funeral for Dan Yeary, and so Larry, when I was a teenager, came and was one of the ministers there. Another intern there who made a big difference in my life was a man named Louis Giglio, who now runs the Passion Conference in Atlanta. That's pretty amazing. Louis made a big impact on my life spiritually. Even after being an intern at Tallawood one summer, when I was in high school, I went off to college, and Louis was at Baylor at that time, getting his another degree, and started a Bible study at Baylor. And it started, you know, like seven or eight people in an apartment complex. And then the next week I went, and there was about 12 or 13 people. The next week there was 24. And pretty soon, by my senior year at Baylor, there was like 900 kids going to this Bible study, which Louis has now expanded into this amazing movement, really, for college kids in spirituality. And so, I still look up to Louis in terms of ideas, theological ideas, and things like that. So,
when did the profession of faith come? Was that at Tallawood?
When I was 9 or 10. Okay. Yeah. I said something at the funeral also that, you know, when your parents are devoted Christians, you sort of go along for the ride. A lot of times, a lot of people do. And then hopefully something else happens to make your faith your own. And one of those things was I heard Dan Yeary at a revival when I was in seventh grade. And it really kind of lit the fuse a little bit more. And then Louis, and then I've had really amazing people that have sort of, you know, that have said things that I've really felt like I've connected with and that kind of helped me along.
Now, Greg, may I now present to the jury, this is Exhibit A, all right? Y'all see this? Now, that's Mary and Jesus. This is the manger. It is December. This is a Christmas card, what it looks like. But no. This is, can I just tell you all, a cradle roll enrollment certificate, I guess. And the name on the top is James Gregory Guy Funderburk. So tell us, Greg, really and truly, you were a South Mainer on the cradle roll.
Yeah, I was. I found this after my parents died. We looked through some scrapbooks and things, and I found this, and I had no idea.
Really?
That I was on the cradle roll at South Main. I mean, I guess I
could, Larry, come on,
put it together. But I grew up at Tallawood, so I thought we'd always gone to Tallawood. But apparently, I know my parents did go to some of the singles things around here in the early 60s. And I think maybe even some of y'all knew them. But yeah, I was on the crater roll, as it turns out. So I was really excited to find this.
James is a family name?
Yeah, my whole name is James Gregory Guy Funderburk.
All right.
James is my maternal grandfather's name. Gregory is the name that my parents liked because To Kill a Mockingbird had just come out.
It's good. Gregory Peck.
My mom really liked Gregory Peck. And then Guy is my paternal grandfather's name, which is also funny. He was one of 16 kids, and he was the second to last.
And they weren't Catholic.
Third to last. Maybe he was the third to last. And all the other brothers and sisters have these elaborate names, like, you know, Robert Jefferson Funderburk, and you know, just these like three or four just kind of regal names. And then by the time they got to my granddad, his name is
Guy
Funderburk. No middle name, none, nothing.
Guy.
So
that's kind of funny. So, what then? So we were born cradle roll. We go to Hollywood with family. You grow up there. And now you're in high school, going to college. What brought you to South Maine?
Well, I guess when I got out of law school, I came down here and began practicing law with Funderburk and Funderburk, which my dad and Larry's firm, as an associate. And by the way, learned a ton under Larry, just following Larry around and occasionally trying a case with Larry, which is a remarkable experience, as y'all probably could imagine. Is just, I always remember that, like, when you'd be with Larry in a deposition or be with him in trial, I'd be listening, and maybe I've done some preparation, so I know what's going on in the case a good deal. And I'm thinking, he is not asking the question that he needs to ask this witness. He needs to get to this point. And invariably, Larry would, at the end or near the end, ask the question in a way that I had never thought of, or postured the question in a way that I could never even have dreamed of, that was so effective. And was just so great in front of a jury, just so down to earth and common sense, and very persuasive too. And so learned a lot from Larry as far as the legal practice, and my dad as well. I never got to try a case with my dad, but I got to go to some depositions with him. And it was always really funny because my dad was very stern at home, very much a disciplinarian, and Larry was happy-go-lucky Larry, would take you fishing, would go get a burger with you. But then when you got to the office, it would completely turn around. My dad was this affable, kind of walk around the halls, greeting everybody. And Larry was like in his office, just moving the next case. So that was disorienting to me, but I guess I got used to it.
I guess Larry. Oh,
when you asked me
how you got
here,
to South Maine,
I was pulling a perk.
Yeah, you were. Anyway.
Yeah. How did I get back to South Maine? Kelly and I married in '93 and began looking for a church. We didn't want to go back to Tallawood because that's kind of where I grew up. You know, there's bodies buried back there, you know, so just kidding. But so we really liked Dr. Turner, and we just began coming to church here, and pretty soon we had two kids, and they grew up here, and have just been, you know, very happy, gotten very involved with different committees and different, you know, positions and things like that.
So tell us about the boys. We're talking about Hank, and we're talking about Charlie. Charlie's still with us. Hank is now gone.
Yeah, Hank's gone to California.
So yeah.
Hank was born in 1998, and he is he's a very, very smart and intuitive kid. I coached both of them in baseball a lot. Hank tolerated it, and then got to about the time that he was going to leave middle school. He kind of got the acting bug, theater bug, and he went to the High School for Visual and Performing Arts and was an actor there, and then has gone to the University of Southern California for the rest of his college, and is doing great there. He's a junior, and he's a business major. Started out as a math major, now he's a business major. And still does a good bit of theater. He usually does a play, you know, every semester, and he's doing just doing terrific. I'm very proud of how he's doing.
And Charlie?
And Charlie was born in 2003. He is he's again smart kid, very great EQ. Like he's really tied in with how people are responding. He's kind of more quiet than Hank, but real funny. I mean, he's. It's funny when he stings Hank with a barb or something because Hank is not expecting it. We call him the baby-faced assassin. Charlie's great. He is a sophomore at Streck Jesuit, and he likes sort of this the rigor of that, and also has really enjoyed learning some of the Jesuit practices, which I've tried to learn about too. That I've really embraced is maybe too strong a word, but have enjoyed reading about the imagination of the Jesuits.
We've got a few of our youth that are at Strake with Ty and Kyle and Ethan. Who are involved at Strake Jesuit. That's really cool. And it's funny, he's right about Charlie. I've watched the transformation just in my 6 years when I first got here. Charlie was sort of this shorter, quiet, kind of reserve, you know, always there, you know, but not always reactive or not always, you know, boisterous and sharing thoughts and the feelings and things or trying to get him to sing, even in choir, you know, trying to. And now, Lord have mercy, that child. He is making folks laugh. You're right about the response, and he's very astute. He's very aware, but he's always got a smile on his face, and he's just a great kid. Everybody loves Charlie. Everybody loves Charlie.
Yeah, he plays football at Strake, and he plays a little bit. He's just whatever groupie, and he kind of becomes the mascot, sort of.
Yeah. So we're in midlife now. We're going into transitioning a little bit later. Where again? So we're doing law. You're having the boys. You're growing up and doing probably Little League like crazy. A lot of baseball. I know that just from my first time coming to South Maine. What was the call to ministry? What brought you into or got you into that transition?
It's really sort of a long journey, and it's more interesting, I guess, to look back on. I think, after practicing law probably, 17, 18 years, I guess I began to think, okay, am I going to do this my whole life, or maybe would I perhaps do something else? In the meantime, I was becoming very active here at South Maine, committee, you know, long-range planning, just all sorts of things that really sort of, I was just very interested. My heart kind of beat a little faster when I was working on church stuff, maybe even more than some of the law things that I was doing. And Kelly noticed that. I kind of thought maybe, I wonder if, and I was on a couple of boards, I thought, well, maybe I could be like a general counsel to a nonprofit or something like that. And then sort of the opportunity came when Aaron left for Waco, I began to think, it's kind of far-fetched, but maybe that's something that I might be interested in. And in the meantime, my parents had passed away. My dad had passed away. My mom was in that kind of area sick as well. My mom had a long-term dementia for about 20, 21 years that just steadily got worse and worse from about 19, late 80s on, and was slowing down. But my dad was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and so both of them were sick at the same time. And I just think I learned a lot from being a caregiver to them. And we were blessed to be able to hire people to care for them day to day, but just the caregiving, just kind of I don't know that. There was something pastoral in that I felt at home with, and maybe just because it was actually at my home and with my parents. But there was that piece. And then when my parents passed away, especially my dad had passed away, I just had a little bit, maybe a little bit of detachment from the firm. And I knew it was in great shape with Larry and my brother who had joined by then. And sort of just all these things sort of converged to the possibility of maybe something new. And then we were at, and I've told this story before, but we were at the Wells house, and Steve was doing some presentation to some youth parents, and he said something about ministry, and he said, well, yeah, if we could get, you know, Greg to take a pay cut, we could, you know, we could fill this space.
Steve would never say something like that. No, I don't believe it.
And so when your wife has noticed something like that, and then your pastor notices something like that, I think you have to lean in. And I did.
It's
remarkable that it happened.
I was always touched by hearing Steve's telling, and I don't have the words, but, you know, Steve sort of disclosed a little bit of the moment when they brought Kelly, I think, into an interview. Is that right? Wasn't Kelly the one? And they asked, and she just gave you this glowing, like, kind of a direct, is that right? Was it Kelly? The ordination council. That wasn't your interview. Yeah, why would you bring the wife in for an interview? Should we hire the guy? No. But it was the ordination. That's right. It was the ordination council. But about Greg's being ordained and just hearing Steve tell those words about what Kelly said about you was just, I just remember being touched by that.
That is two layers of lot of gloss. Of Kelly glossing it over all my faults and mistakes. And then Steve glossing over Kelly's gloss over. I'm very much the beneficiary of a lot of
beneficiaries gloss. Are us because a lot of gloss. But we are all beneficiaries of that, Greg. I mean, the journey with your parents. I mean, it's interesting how life shapes us, and you have blessed us through that experience, and so I know we are grateful. And now everything in his past, especially the law part, they're all components of paperweights in his office. So it's really funny. There's this like jagged piece of metal, and I said, "What is this?" It looked like a shear that you use to like shear a dog or sheep or something. I didn't know what it was, and he kept wanting me to guess what it was. I don't know what it is, and he said, "Yeah, it's a piece of escalator." Evidently, one of his cases was an escalator case.
I tried a case in Beaumont about an escalator accident, and so I always try to keep little artifacts of my cases.
So they're all paperweights in his office. Sorry, that's a random fact. No, that's really great, and I'm looking at this.
Well, I do find. Let me just say that. I mean, it is interesting now that I get to use my law. I still keep my license, and I review contracts, and I don't have any clients, but I advise people from time to time, church members, about different things, wills and estates, and that's not my specialty, but I help people navigate things. And then same with pastoral care, just having care for my parents and done visitation here at church. I just think without me knowing, certainly God was working behind the scenes like God does to prepare you for something different.
It is amazing. These are the things that may not be on the job description for this position, but yet Greg offers weekly to our congregation. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. My first sermon I heard at South Main Baptist Church was my interview week or weekend, whatever, and I came in, and it was Greg Funderburk who preached that day. I think it was during the summer, so Steve may have been traveling or with the youth or something. I don't quite remember, but it was Greg, and I think it was actually your first sermon, was it?
It was probably one of my first, but it was
pretty
it was
close.
Among my first, yeah.
And that weekend, or maybe shortly after the ordination,
figuring out how to do it.
Well, maybe it was shortly after the ordination because one of Greg's illustrations was about how Bono, the lead singer for the group U2, gave Greg on a cell phone video a blessing. Of his ordination. And I'm sitting there thinking, okay, this is too cool that this guy's got this for a... and it was first then that I learned about your affinity and love for U2.
Yeah. I've always been... Probably when I was in high school, I went to this party. It was at Rice University. I was in high school. But they, in this band, played this song. And I go, that song was awesome. What was that? And I went up to the lead singer. I go, what was that? And he goes, oh, this is by this new Irish band called U2. It was like 1979. And so I've been a big U2 fan, this Irish rock band that is has a Christian message to most of their songs and lyrics, and have done Sunday school series on U2. And so Ruth Campos, again, just says that's God winking at you. But what happened was my sister texted me and said, hey, I think Bono is on my plane.
On Southwest.
Yeah. But it was Southwest Airlines. So I go, Bono is not on your plane on Southwest Airlines. She goes, it looks like Bono. I think it's Bono. And I go, well, get his autograph or something. So a couple hours pass, and she sends me this video of Bono on the Southwest Airlines flight.
Do you still have it?
Well, I'm finished.
Oh, sorry. It's my first time.
Yeah. And so he says Bono things. He quotes Matthew, and he says, on this your ordination. She goes, what's his name? What's his name again? She goes, Greg. Greg, on your ordination, may God bless you. And, you know, he's looking right in the camera. And Susan sends me, my sister sends this to me, and I go, this is incredible. And so what I did with that sermon was, you know, that's just so unlikely. Like, was that really Bono, or was it some impersonator? And I tied that into Thomas seeing Jesus, and Thomas sees Jesus and can say, you know, I put my fingers into your wounds and through the holes on your finger, and so Thomas knew it was Jesus, but we have to step back and say, do we believe that even though we didn't see it, even though we weren't there? And that's kind of like this video, is was that really Bono or not? And I'm convinced it is. However, when I changed phones, I lost the video.
Brutal.
So blessed are those who believe without actually seeing.
Yeah. So I will say, I had the fortunate experience of going to the U2 concert here when they were last year, a year or two ago, and Greg, I got the chance to go with Greg, and I'm up there, and everybody's screaming, we've all got our lights on, and everybody's dancing, one love, we're all singing and everything, and I look down to the left on our row, and there's Greg. I'm screaming and shouting and singing and having a good time at this concert, and Greg is literally worshiping. And I kid you not worshiping Bono, but Greg is literally sitting down. He's the only guy in the whole, all of NRG, and he's sitting down like this, just kind of in this prostrate sort of prayerful position. And I'm sitting there, and it just dawned on me how this art, this expression of this band, really did impact you.
Yeah, I mean, it was church to me.
I was like, Greg.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Oh, you know, it was an obvious.
Yeah, I just think that, and I think this is in a lot of different art. It's just there's so much layer to it. You may enjoy it on one level because you like it sonically, or you like, you know, the way the stage is set up and the sound and the everything. But the lyrics are very meaningful, and the more you dig into them, the more you find that this is based upon, you know, this scripture, or this is based on this moment in his life that this encounter with God occurred, or it's the same way with paintings now too, that you just find so much in art. If you just engage your imagination, it seems to me at least that God speaks so vividly in the art that we see around us.
So clearly we see the poetry and how you extract meaning from the words. All of us have experienced the bulletins, the worship guides, where Greg almost, it's either a baseball illustration or it's going to be a painting by some unknown author, to me at least. I learned so much from Greg from the art standpoint. So where did that impetus come from, like this art?
I think generally, and I look back and I see there are lawyers in my family and there were ministers in my family. My great grandfather was a minister, and many of his brothers, a couple of his brothers at least. And my mom was an artist in a sense. She didn't, you know, sell anything, but she was always doing beautiful collages and paintings. And even in her work at Tier, there was one lady that was in a iron lung polio victim who she taught to paint with her mouth, with a mouthpiece, who did just these beautiful paintings named Lynn Campbell. And so she used art herself to communicate and so I think that's sort of where that came from. But really the way that it manifested was just teaching Sunday school. Like I would find something that I was teaching in Sunday school and I was thinking, well, how do I make this come alive? And so you just start doing some searches on the internet for images about, you know, Jesus healing a blind man, and you'd come up with this beautiful image by some, 1600, 1700 era painter, and it could just make the text come alive and interest people, and they would all have a comment about something, you know, something serious or something funny, or it just engaged people really well. And so I just began to use that a lot and to learn, especially in Watershed, which was for our young singles, seemed to, you know, connect with them. And I just found that that really, really spoke to them, but it spoke to me too. Like, you know, if you read something, it jumps off the page with an image, then you sort of, I guess, lean into that a little bit.
Well, this introspective look at art reminds me of something. Now, you may realize or not that on our pastoral team, there are some introverts and there are some extroverts. That might be a surprise to you. Maybe, maybe not. It's not uncommon for us to be on staff retreat, which we have coming up very shortly here in a week or two. And all of a sudden, all of us are meeting and we're just like, where's Greg? It's Greg. Greg's not here. We're all eating chocolate and focusing and laughing and looking at calendars. And all of a sudden, you know, we realize somebody's not with us. Greg, tell us about how hard it is being probably the lone introvert. Brad tends to maybe have an introverted sliver, but I think you're kind of the guy. So how hard is it being with all of us extroverts?
That's none of your business.
Nice.
No, tough interview. No, come on.
I wish I would have learned this about myself earlier, like in college or even after that I get drained from being around a lot of people with a lot of energy.
Back off.
And I need to be alone. I just need to check out sometimes and be by myself, and I'm not doing anything, you know, I'm praying necessarily, but I'm just being a little bit more meditative and slow my mind down and or think about my own things, or and I just need to check out. I get energy from being away from people to recharge, then I drain when I'm with a big group a lot.
Well, and here's the truth, beauty of this is that our pastoral team is so collaborative and so self-actualizing that we realize certain of us need to plug out or plug in. And the beauty of that is, in our planning, a lot of times of our worship services or our programming and events, you know, we allow that voice to be said, because guess what? Are you all extroverts? Are you all introverts? So our congregation is made up of the spectrum. And I think it's important when we worship, it's important when we have programming to just realize that everyone experiences and feels God's presence in different ways. And to allow space for that within our pastoral team allows us to have space for that with you, which I think is kind of a cool thing. So I got a few more minutes and I got one last question. And I think this is an intriguing one, because I will speak truthfully, Greg. Amazing sermons, watching you love on these folks, all of us, really. I confide in Greg personally a lot, and amazed at just the knowledge. That's why we rolled our eyes about your intellect, just because so much is in that brain of yours, that you are able to share pastorally and encouragingly. I'm intrigued to know, I always want to ask, what's the next step? Because I think a lot of us know with associates or pastoral, you know, associates or people in positions that aren't head pastors, is it a stepping stone? So I want to know, what's the future for Greg Funderburk? Are we going to get a search committee coming in this church anytime soon? What's going on? What's going on? Tell us, Greg.
Nice setup there, Kerry.
It's like an alley-oop. There it is.
Yeah. No, I people ask me, well, what's the difference between law and being a pastor, and you know, what's that like? And I just tell them, you know, the quality of my life right now is so nice. It's so great. I enjoy what I do. I like the intellectual challenge of preaching and teaching. Really enjoy that. I write a lot, both for the church and, you know, on my own too, and that's something that I really, really enjoy, to be introspective about things and then write. And I love being with y'all, especially. And this is kind of the hardest thing. We had a meeting yesterday with the McNeils. We're doing Frances McNeil, Dave McNeil's mother's funeral on Thursday at 10 o'clock. And the times that you get to talk to families about their families, and especially, sadly, when they lose someone, is just such a sacred honor to hear those stories. I talked to someone just this morning in my office that was from a funeral home, and she had helped with the yearly service and had experienced that and heard all of that, and then is also helping with the McNeil family. And she goes, and there's the Yeary family, the Wells family is so amazing, and now the McNeil family, just remarkable. And I go, they're everywhere around here. They're everywhere around here. And it's just such a incredible church with wonderful people. And just to be able to connect into your lives it really is an honor. So no, I have no ambition to be a senior pastor anywhere. That does not appeal to me at all. Who knows, Act 3, what people do, but I love to write. I love to, think about what can make something better. I like to problem solve. So who knows, but I don't anticipate going anywhere anytime soon.
Well, and Greg has a sabbatical that is up and coming. So Greg, know that we will, as a church, be praying for you as you enter into that season of time where you can be all the introvert you want to be. And that's right. Get it out of your system. But no, for you to be able to dig a little deeper and see where God and what God has in store for you in the years to come. Ladies and gentlemen, one more. Go ahead.
No, that's all I said. Thank you for that. I appreciate that. And it wasn't quite as painful as I thought it might be.
Greg Funderburk, ladies and gentlemen, Greg Funderburk.